Hello and welcome to Real Talk. This is the show that seeks answers to questions big and small. We're here every Tuesday at noon, so thank you for joining us at lunchtime. Today, our big question is the politics of climate change and talking to diverse audiences about that very subject. I have with me an expert in that area. He is John Doherty, a citizen activist from Citizen Climate Lobby, Tacoma Chapter. Welcome, John.
Hey, good to be here. Thank you.
And this is not the first time you've been here.
Nope, and maybe there'll be some more.
As climate change progresses and as the Citizen Climate Lobby progresses in your activities, I hope we will hear more from you. I want to start with the idea of differing opinions and kind of where we stand with those. You have a report from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, first off, that Yale Program on Climate Change is an awesome source of information for anybody who cares about climate change and what the various opinions are. It's accessible on the internet. They've got data going back 10 years or so, and it's granular down to the zip code area, so people can find out what the spectrum of opinions are where they live or nationwide. The big picture from them, based on their research over these few years, is that they've discovered there are six Americas. They call them six different Americas. And I can go over those six types if that's appropriate.
Yes, please do.
Sure. Okay, well, what we have is a spectrum from those on one end who are alarmed, i.e. people who are really concerned about the future for our children, our grandchildren, and the earth and the general environment, all the way to the other end where people are dismissive. And so we have in the spectrum, we have the alarmed, the concerned, the cautious, the disengaged, the doubtful, and the dismissive. So I already mentioned who the alarmed were. The concerned are folks that recognize that climate change is a problem, but they really aren't at the point where they're taking action yet, even perhaps to the extent of writing to their congressperson. In the middle, we've got the cautious folks, and they're aware that there may be some problem, but not quite sure if they should do anything about it or how much they should be concerned. And then next to them, we have the disengaged, and those are mostly people who have got something else going on in their lives that's consuming them. They may have a health issue, or they're living in poverty. They just don't have the space to worry about what's going to happen to the climate in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We have the doubtful. They're really skeptical. You know, the climate always changes. You can't trust the scientists, that kind of thing. And then on the very end of the spectrum are the dismissive. These are the hoaxers, the deniers, the conspiratorialists. And so that's pretty much the spectrum. There is some good news in there, I think. And that is, if we look, the alarm, concern, and cautious, according to the Yale program, they comprise 72% of the populace. So that really means that most people, three-fourths of the people in the United States, are at least open to taking some steps to address the problem of climate change, recognize that it's real.
And, you know, it's interesting. We talked before we got on the air about how humans arrive at these particular categories of opinion on climate change. And you talked a lot about how this is innate in our human nature. How do we get to this polarization, essentially?
We all come from different backgrounds. We have different experiences. Our experiences are unique to us. We have our childhoods, we have our education, and we probably have our natural predispositions, but there are a number of qualities that we all share as human beings that impact in very powerful ways the opinions we have and how strongly we hold on to those opinions. Some of them, I think one of the most interesting is what the social scientists call cognitive dissonance. It's kind of a wonky sounding term, but it's pretty easy to understand, and we all are subject to it. So what it means basically is we have this set of beliefs or ideas, our worldview, how we go about living our lives that develops over time. And we all basically think it's a pretty good way of looking at things and doing things. Of course, there's a huge spectrum of the answers that we come up with. The cognitive dissonance part kicks in when there's some evidence that perhaps our worldview might not be as accurate as we thought, but yet we identify with our worldview. So a simple example I like to use is give a cigarette smoker back in the 50s or 60s who's rationalized his or her practice of smoking cigarettes, and then it becomes more and more evident that this is deleterious to the person's health. That's a problem because the person likes their cigarettes, but there's evidence that this might not be good for them, and that creates discordance in the mind. How am I going to do this? Am I going to change my habit? Am I going to believe something different, and so on? So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of cognitive dissonance. So if somebody's a denier or doesn't like government programs or whatever, and there's a proposal to take governmental measures, which really we have to do, that creates an awkward, uncomfortable feeling for that person.
Well, and then it seems as though, in your understanding of this, that we have exacerbated the impacts of cognitive dissonance with what you're calling confirmation bias through so many different venues now available to people to listen to only those who share their beliefs. Tell us a little bit about that confirmation bias and how it is exacerbated by social media, essentially.
Yeah, well, once again, confirmation bias is something that we're all subject to, so it's not something I can point at somebody else and say, you've got confirmation bias and I don't, because I do. And what that means simply is that when we scan the, let's call it the data horizon for information, we tend to pick out information that will confirm what we already believe. And that's one way of avoiding cognitive dissonance. We don't have to go through, oh, there's this piece of data that contradicts what I believe. Oh, that's uncomfortable. So if we just disregard all the data that contradicts our closely held beliefs, then what we're doing is confirmation bias. So I experience that in myself. There are certain news shows that I like to watch because I can listen to them, watch, and it's like, yep. And if I look at a different perspective news show, I hear stuff that's awkward for me to hear. I don't want to hear that. And you're absolutely right. It gets really severely exacerbated by our social media. So a simple example would be Google News. Google keeps track of what we click on, and it gives us more of what we click on. So our field of view becomes narrower and narrower. It does reinforce our worldview, so we become more and more convinced of the correctness, the rightness of our worldview, and at the same time, the incorrectness of other people's worldviews. And we end up with the kind of polarized society that we have right now.
So we get pretty solidly fixed in our own views. They continue to be confirmed by our choice of information venues. So then we go to the politics of climate change and how that is impacted by this polarization in our country right now. And if we are going to try and make political changes or legislative changes, what happens to the politics? What sorts of laws or proposals are out there now, and how are they doing in the legislatures?
Well, let me just kind of go over briefly what I see as some of the major initiatives that are out there. And there are initiatives coming from both the left and the right. So one of the themes that I see is that there is the realistic possibility of us taking somewhat of a bipartisan approach towards the climate change crisis. And so a good example of this is George Shultz. He was the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan, what you would call a Republican elder statesman. and James Baker and several other men of similar stature have made a very specific proposal under the umbrella of their organization, the Climate Leadership Council. And their proposal is quite similar to most of the proposals, and that is that there's a price put on carbon. As you put a price on something, there's less of it consumed. It makes competing sources of energy or whatever more attractive. So it's a very well thought out program that they're pushing, and so on. So that we see that from a conservative source. Most people are aware of Al Gore's program, Climate Reality. Mm-hmm. It's an educational program. Once again, they're more, I'd say they're fairly diverse in their approach, but that's an approach coming from the left to a certain extent. We recently watched Governor Inslee's tax on fossil fuel bill struggle in the legislature and eventually not pass. But once again, that's a similar kind of approach. We're going to put a price on fossil fuel and so on. There's an organization called Alliance for Clean Jobs and Energy here in Washington State. And my understanding is they've been sort of waiting to see what happened in the legislature. The legislature didn't come up with anything. So now they've filed an initiative, and I'm assuming they're going to be out gathering signatures here pretty soon. That's kind of an overview of some of the proposals that are out there.
And those proposals tend to focus on taxing carbon, essentially, making it expensive, the cap and trade thing, which basically says you polluters have to pay for your pollution, and as you do, the price will go up each year.
Yeah,
am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's basically right. The cap and trade is a little different than putting a price on carbon explicitly. And California's got a cap and trade program that they've been using for a couple years now, 2015, and they're reasonably happy with it. Essentially, polluters, quote unquote, pay a fee to pollute, and if they can reduce the amount they're polluting, they can sell the rights they have to pollute, quote unquote, to some other organization. So that actually makes reducing pollution an asset, and the state can squeeze the top of what's allowed in terms of pollution over time.
Is that a fairly similar model to some of these other proposals that basically charge polluters for polluting?
No, I'd say not. It's a fairly significantly identifiable subset of the approach towards carbon pollution. Most other proposals specifically put a fee or a tax on the actual producers of the fossil fuels.
Okay. Now, Citizens Climate Lobby has a program that they are proposing as well. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. And as it turns out, this is the program that I would point to as probably the best, and I'll offer a couple of reasons why it's true. First of all, same idea, a price on carbon fuels. And the proposal is that the price increases over time until we get carbon emissions down to a pre-1990 level. So stepping up the costs per ton of carbon production until we get down to the level that we feel that we need to have it. So that's the fee. And by the way, I believe it was actually George Shultz. He said that if a cost to the government is returned to the people, it's a fee, not a tax. So we do like to make the distinction that this is a fee rather than a tax. And here's why. Because those funds that are collected will be returned to households as a dividend, and that they'll be processed through the treasury. The funds will be collected through existing tax structures from the people who are bringing carbon out of the ground or bringing it across the border. And it'll, with a very small administrative cost be distributed, much in the same way that Social Security or something like that's distributed. And households will be entitled to spend those monies however they want. We could assume that with this fee that the cost of carbon fuel is going to go up, so they can apply that to the extra cost of the fuels, or they can, the process would make clean energy like solar, wind, et cetera, more attractive financially. And we can assume that, that will change people's energy habits.
So that's looking to me like it would be a popular bill if indeed it got into Congress. So all these things you're talking about, for the most part, are proposals created by organizations who want to support climate control, the reduction of climate change. But none of them are actual legislative proposals.
Yeah, that's right. Well, just for starters, bills have to originate with a representative in Congress. Outside organizations can create model bills or ideas. They can lobby. They can make grassroots efforts and so on and so forth. As far as I know, and I'm fairly confident on this, there's really no significant bill in Congress that's got any kind of energy to it. So what we're waiting for is for Congress to get to the point where they're willing to do that. And that's really one of the very significant places where we as voters come in. If we don't make a racket, if we don't make our voices heard, then we're likely to be stuck with the status quo.
You're listening to Real Talk, and my guest today is John Doherty, an activist from Citizens Climate Lobby Tacoma Chapter. We're able to do this thanks to Windermere Vachon Real Estate for their support, making our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, with Real Talk. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime, and we are talking with John Doherty about climate change solutions and the politics thereof. So, John, you're saying that there are no substantive proposals currently in Congress, that is federal Congress. Tell us about the Climate Solutions Caucus in Congress.
Yeah, well, it's easy to, let's say, be a little pessimistic looking at Congress and our present administration, but there are significant reasons for optimism and for us to give the energy to moving things ahead. And the Climate Solutions Caucus is a wonderful example of that. It's a caucus that by its structure requires an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. So right now we're up to either 72 or 74, I believe it's changed recently, of members of this caucus who are committed to addressing the issue of climate change. This caucus has been in existence only for a little over 2 years, and it's grown from just one Republican and one Democrat in that time to 72 or 74 at this time. So as time passes, as the impacts of global warming become more and more obvious, things like flooded streets in Miami or the biggest wildfire ever in California, the experience in Puerto Rico, locally here, the Quinault tribe out on the peninsula having to move their village because of the impacts of global warming, or the fact that their salmon run is significantly decreased because the glacier that normally feeds the Quinault River is basically gone. All impacts of climate change. So the energy is growing, and our job is to keep pushing.
That's pretty shocking, actually, when you put it in those specifics. So it is all about politics. And what can we the people do to support the idea of a bipartisan approach to solving the problems caused by climate change? How do we talk to each other?
Yeah, well, I think the very first thing is the willingness to talk. I mean, I find it in myself that if I'm in a conversation with somebody that I know is skeptical of taking steps to address climate change. It's an awkward situation for me. One of my good friends talking about this, she said, well, my solution to that problem is to just avoid that conversation. That's a very human thing to do. But I also think that if other people are willing to take on those conversations, and I think this is critical, from the perspective of trying to understand the other person's point of view, because of some of the things we talked about a little earlier, we are identified with our point of view. So if I go into a conversation with a person who is skeptical about global warming with a bunch of facts and figures that basically attack that person's point of view, that person is going to interpret that as a personal attack.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, honestly, this is a human condition, and the same thing can happen to me. So if I can go into that conversation with a desire to understand, to authentically understand, not to give lip service to understanding, but to understand why this other fellow human being has come to this point of view, that's a wonderful step towards having an authentic conversation. Then at that point, I can start looking for things like shared value. I mean, most of us, one way or the other, really value, for instance, the beauty of the Pacific Northwest. We love the mountains, we love the sound, we love the rivers, we love the glaciers, we like the snow in the winter. Personally, I love the rain too. Not everybody shares that point of view. But if we can start with that value of loving the environment, then we've got a basis for a conversation.
I've always felt that if you walked into a room of even climate deniers and said, who in this room wants to see the earth destroyed? No one's going to stand up. I don't know if that would start with a shared value or if that feels like a personal attack. One of the things you've mentioned here in some information that you gave me is emotional appeal. So if a person is doggedly attached to their opinion and to their beliefs, how do we find an emotional appeal perhaps in those shared values?
Yeah, well, I do think that the approach based on our feelings is much more likely to be successful than kind of a logical, linear, data-based approach. So I think shared values is a part of that, but also an empathetic kind of communication. I was at a meeting not too long ago that Derek Kilmer spoke at for a period of time, and the very first slide he put up was a picture of his family.
Who's Derek Kilmer?
Yeah, Derek Kilmer's the representative from, U.S. representative from Washington 6. That's where I live down in Tacoma. So the very first thing he put up was a picture of him and his family, his wife and his two children, which basically pretty much created a connection right off the bat. We all value and love our families, and those are emotional things. So to think about what I'm leaving for my children and my grandchildren, I'm going to share those values with somebody else. What I'm borrowing from my children or grandchildren. So this kind of empathetic, emotional connection based on shared values is probably going to be way more effective than essentially using brute facts to pound the other person into submission. It's just not going to happen.
Well, you've been involved in activism for climate change for quite some time. What success have you had in turning climate deniers or even those that are just ambivalent around?
Well, I think one of the keys is that we have to have the right person talking to a particular audience. So if we're talking to, let's say, a group of conservative Christians, a church group in a conservative denomination, we want to find somebody that shares those values to talk to those people. The value, the connection to the folks from the presenter is critically important.
And how much success have you seen with that approach?
Well, there's been significant success. Let me just point to Citizens Climate Lobby as an example. We've only been in existence since around 2007. We started off with 15 members. And right now, we're nibbling on 100,000 members.
Wow.
We have over 500 chapters around the United States. The membership of Citizens Climate Lobby doubles every year. And of course, as we get bigger and bigger, that doubling seems to be more and more of a challenge, but it's happening. And I think that's very representative of the growing awareness across all segments, all aspects, all perspectives of our society. One of the things I just learned is that there are young Republican groups. These are young college students around the United States. They're millennials, and they're taking a fresh look. So even though they have conservative points of view, they see the challenge of global warming. They've heard the message, and they're actively working towards solutions to climate change.
That's impressive. The numbers for Citizens Climate Lobby and the young Republicans who are willing to address the issue of climate change. You mentioned a study by Dr. Celia Paris regarding the public perception and the political value of bipartisanship. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think stating the obvious that we're living in a pretty polarized culture at the time. And it's gotten tribal, and it's very much us versus them. And our politicians, they seem to be trapped with this kind of us versus them polarized approach to things. And of course, we have activists on both the left and the right who are, to a certain extent, calling the tune that the politicians are following, and that leads to further polarization. So the work that Dr. Paris did, she's a social scientist. She's done a lot of research. So this is just not her idea. This is based on a lot of good clinical research. Is that there's really an untapped wellspring in the populace in the United States wishing for a somewhat more bipartisan approach to our politics. I think a lot of people are just tired of the back and forth, we're right, you're wrong, and then it coming back across the net exactly the other way. So she's pointed out to politicians that they are much better thought of by the voting populace all across the spectrum if they are willing to be open to a bipartisan approach. This doesn't mean that the left and right disappear. It just means that.
And I believe the conclusion also is that those laws that are enacted with a bipartisan approach have a much better chance of surviving the next administration. In other words, changing administrations can often mean changing policy, which is something we're experiencing now with the current administration trying to destroy everything the previous administration did, just because it maybe wasn't necessarily a bipartisan kind of thing. There were regulations. We're running out of time, and there are some things you wanted to add. I think how does the average person kind of soften themselves to approach conversations about climate change in an open sort of way? What sort of resources can you give us?
Well, let's just say, please be willing to have the conversation, as difficult as it is. Take it on as a personal growth project to listen to somebody who's got a very different point of view. And then from within that framework, be willing to understand. Be willing to show that person you understand their point of view. I get it. You're worried that government is going to be too powerful, or you're worried that you're going to be taxed in a way you can't afford. So there are a couple of books that I would like to recommend, if I could, for those who want to be well-versed. One of them is called Dire Predictions. It's by Michael Mann and Lee Kump. It's the place to start. It's well-illustrated, and it's accessible to the layperson. Another book I'd like to recommend is written by Catherine Hayhoe. She's a climate scientist. She's also an evangelical Christian. And her book is How to Talk to Evangelicals About Global Climate Change. Her book's called The Climate for Change. And I'd highly recommend that.
Thank you, John Doherty. You've been listening to Real Talk. Our subject today has been climate change and how to talk about it, how to deal with the politics thereof. Thanks for listening. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to hear on The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Thanks for listening.